Thank you very much for those kind words. I've been a teacher all my life. It was wonderful. There was a period in the middle of the first section where there was just total silence from one end of the room to the other. Not a gasp. Everybody working away with their pens. It was great. It almost made me want to go back to teaching again. I want to begin with an epigraph, and this is an epigraph taken from a review of an Irish poet by an English critic. I never want to read another poem by an Irish poet in which his grandfather enters or emerges from a shed. That's right, a shed. On Monday, grandfather visits his shed at least twice. He carries what looks like blackout curtains, a sizable chandelier, and a case of Bud Light. On Tuesday, he has a one-man stream of traffic. Into the shed go maps of all the oceans of the world, a telescope, numerous buckets of black earth, and a crate of Guinness. On Wednesday, he tips 10 wheelbarrows of cut grass in a corner of the shed, fits in a small apple tree with fruit on the branches, and 6 bottles of fruity Australian red. Surely no room for more. But on Thursday, the shed roof creaks open like a convertible's to make room for huge replicas of sun and moon, and an array of cocktails with parasols. Imagine the chaos on Friday, when he coaxes a garden full of wild beasts and creeping things into a shed that seemed to expand invisibly when he clicks his tongue. So much dark rum, so much cider to pack on Saturday, he fetches a man and woman to complete the task and take up residence in the shed. Their work finished, on Sunday, they drink all day. Telling the English to keep their hands off our sheds. I suppose that poem is what academics refer to as a creation myth. I grew up in County Fermanagh, which is about 100 miles from Belfast on one side and 100 miles from Dublin on the other. I suppose the cinema was the main source of entertainment. But there was one memorable occasion when there was a big Elvis Presley convention. The Ballygolly Elvis strutted, chest exposed, in white bell bottoms. Practice curls of the lip from the Oma Elvis and a handful of diaphanous scarves to be thrown into the crowd. The Bundoran Elvis managed so much droop on his lopsided smile, he appeared to be having a stroke. Everyone was in a Vegas frame of mind, rhinestones fingered as though they were rosary beads. 3 hours later, I sat with the disappointed, their makeup beginning to run. Slowly they circled back to themselves, morose, deflated, and less than they had been. 40 years in Elvis, one lamented, and nothing to show. Already, it was too late. Young hip swingers were coming through in Carrickmacross and Caledon and Donegal Town, sounding more like the real thing than the real thing. His sunglasses, his glossy sideburns would all go to waste unless he could reinvent himself. As Engelbert Humperdinck, for example. Or Roy Orbison or Johnny Cash. Who would want to be himself any longer than he had to? Mercy, he growls into an imaginary mic, then plays the opening chords of Pretty Woman like a man who has been practicing. For years I was a terrific Catholic. Boy, was I a good Catholic. Serving Mass, serving the old Latin Mass. Singing the national anthem before you knew a word Irish. Altar boy. I cycle to town, rehearsing the Latin responses. Dam quel toffee cat juver tu to me. Me a cowboy, me a Mexican cowboy. I don my surplice and soutane, ring the hand bell, and follow the priest onto the altar. The congregation stand. I am the half priest, perfectly on cue for the next 40 minutes. Old Mrs. Cassidy tells me I'm a great cub. I know this already. Altar boy economics. A wedding paid better than a funeral. We were tipped for smiling and looking cute in photos. Though sometimes a funeral paid better, the mourners at a loss and wanting to be thought generous. Wedding tips could be displayed with a discreet jingle, but funeral tips were almost secrets hoarded for rainy days. A christening did not require an altar boy. Christenings were, economically speaking, a dead loss. The confession box. If the chapel in my hometown ever closes, I want to acquire the confession box to the left of the altar. Its walls seasoned with impure thoughts and actions, some of them mine. Its silent echo, the soft voice of the confessor. Did anything flow, my child? Oh, Jesus was not the reply that was required. At once I'll throw open the doors and set it on fire in the middle of a field. Whether it burns for 2 hours or 2 days, it will become the sin targets of the parish. Past and future, its ashes an end to guilt, an end to penance. Then I shall circle the remains, wondering which commandment, if any, I have just broken. This is a kind of pre-troubled poem called Untroubled. Caesar is flattening Gaul by the light of our tilly. My father has slept with his mouth open since the beginning of the war. My mother is on a cleaning campaign in the furthest corners of her empire. The frozen center of the night is a dog's yowl released between hills. I am translating from the Latin. It is 1962. JFK smiles from our mantelpiece. Before the decade is out, we will fear the unmarked car and thereby the live device thrown into the garden. But on this quiet night, logs are burning out in the stove, and a dog in the hills is fashioning a winter elegy. In my most recent book, there's a set of poems about the, sort of an undercurrent in the book, of poems about the disappeared people who were murdered and buried in bogs and so on. And there are about a dozen poems in the book which are about that. I've interspersed them through the book rather than presenting them as a single section. And I've tried to keep as plain a sort of a style as possible with those poems. There will be a knock. There will be a knock on the front door. He will stand there twisting his hat, saying, "Sorry, I'm late." She checks the mail every day for his handwriting. His room is packed with 9 years of birthday and Christmas gifts. When asked why she does not move away to a place with fewer painful memories, she replies, "But what if he arrives on the doorstep and we are gone? What will he do?" Today there has been information. Today there has been information, and it is time again to ransack the mountain. His mother has hired a psychic, and the slow searcher's walk continues into its 10th year. The mother, as always, carries the photograph of her son on the tilted poker. He might be about to tip the hat and bid us good morrow, or has he been snapped in the chorus line of, say, a musical? Despite his showbiz air, he is not smiling. Even without hindsight, we would register his anxiety. 9 years have passed, and today there has been information. The search parties reform, hope trickles again like a mountain stream they must follow to its source. They search every dip in the heather and consult their notes about flooded hollows and rocks and nameless bushes. 100 anonymous landmarks in a bland landscape that has changed with the seasons. It has been 9 years, and the voice on the telephone was uncertain, and the people, the police, are again pressing for information. The title of the book is The Rain Barrel, and the rain barrel was a kind of a fixture on the farm. I always associated it with security and solidity and some and things not going to waste, you know, the rainfall being caught in the rain barrel. I think I was influenced in this sequence of poems by a book by an English poet called D.J. Enright, who about maybe 20 years ago wrote a book called The Terrible Shears, which was a group of short, it was a book length group of short poems about his childhood. Number two, we acquire the rain barrel. We are the first in the parish to own a rain barrel. Pagan as any thorn, it will brook no nonsense. It is something like something orphaned in a field, and when empty, smells like a hip flask. Fresh duties now, all of them in the realms of water. We install it the same day. The first drip from the spout is a kind of baptism in the family. How long has the rain barrel been in the family? You could have drowned in it as quickly as in a slurry tank or a lint hole. Yet your childhood's growth was measured also against the rusty iron hoops. Two old warriors, the rain barrel and my father, sit with their backs to the wall, one receiving daily the gift of water, the other struggling to accept the gift of air. I don't feel I need to say anything in introduction to these poems, that the romance. Aunt Annie brought the barrel a present once, a cherry blossom beaten by the rain into bruised glory. It was worse than an arranged marriage. The blossom, though floating gamely, succumbed at last to a bedraggled burial at sea. I'm going to read a couple of poems from a sequence I wrote about having contracted, I've forgotten the name of the bloody disease already. One of the side effects is that you forget things. I forget the name of them.
Parkinson's
disease, yeah. And then later on,
diabetes.
By God, I had a couple of nice companions to take with me into retirement. Those two. And I wrote a group of poems about Parkinson's disease. The first one is called Agitans, because at one time that disease was known as paralysis. Agitans. My left arm is jealous of my right, the one without a tremor. When right pours a glass of wine or throws a ball, left stifles a mild shiver of reproach. I call him Agitans and let him take charge of the big jug of water, so that the ice tumbles into the glasses like a subsiding cliff. He peaks in the football season when Arsenal play. If they get any better, I'll have to snuggle him tightly to my chest, straight jackets down. Meanwhile, his brother Wright is undeterred by his burgeoning duties, and once only has released his own answering tremor. Which may sound like good news, but it isn't. I mean, he decides he's moving. One of the side effects of the medicine was that I began to have hallucinations, and this is just commonplace. Not big sort of Thomas De Quincey type hallucination, more minor ones, you know. The best one I can think of to sort of give a sense of this is how when you were a child, you would suddenly wake up and, you know, the bathrobe hanging on the back of the bedroom wall began to look like a monk or some kind of sinister figure. It's more hallucinations in that sense. Why are they not more brash, more lively, these creatures who live in my head? A troop of aerials, say, or some nifty Cirque du Soleil acrobats and clowns. Instead, they pass in a blur, trying to be seen, trying not to be seen. I may never be rid of them, though leave-taking seems their speciality. They slip away out of lamps, statues, vases, cushions, chairs, but without the words or gesture. I want them to slow down once in a while, unsmiling if they will, but they are too busy time-flying. Rashness or loneliness is not, I think, their style. Even as I write, discreetly, deliberately, something rustles out of sight at the gable's edge. That its very presence may be bad news bounces me to my feet. I stride in the garden, then work on an image of lights malfunctioning and light doctors on overtime trying to make repairs. Side effects too. Gone my teacherly gulder. All you allow me on the worst days is my adolescent shriek. The voice that broke at 13 has again broken. Mad swinging in the trees might have sounded like this. Farewell to the dulcet and the mellifluous, though in truth they were never my style. Now, reading aloud, I clear my throat between poems that the words may have right of way, or return patiently to where the sound was scrambled, each lost syllable recovered, having its say. This is the one the children like. Side effects 3. Alone in the house, I fart to the slow movement from Rimsky-Korsakov's Capriccio Espanol, the dazzling morning dance. I set aside Vivaldi's Concert for Two Trumpeters in C major, bought at the Oxfam sale. Tomorrow shines. Who knows what heights I may scale? I looked up jokes about Parkinson's on the internet.
I love your sense of humour.
And this poem is called Friends. And the epigraph is from the internet. Which would you rather have, Parkinson's or Alzheimer's? Parkinson's. I'd rather spill half my pint and forget where the fuck I put it on. When I am disposed to make room for a mild depression or cite the medical history of the tremor in my left arm, which is in good going at the moment there, they shout me down with shaker jokes and quotations. I call them heartless bastards and begin to accept requests. My party piece is called The Plane in the Storm. Then I'm allowed the last quotation from from Yeats's poem in praise of his friends, and charged with a lump in the throat, desire for the woman he loves. He describes how sweetness wells from his heart's root. I shake, Yeats tells us, I shake from head to foot. Arsenal, of course, haven't got any better. This poem is called The Builder. My mother was a farmer's daughter. She did most of the tasks on the land because her brother worked on the local estate. So my memories of her are full of images of her milking cows, cutting turf, building hay, standing at the centre of the hay rick. So this poem is called, it's a kind of an elegy for her, and it's called The Builder. Even at 50, you were in demand. Three hayfields of your handiwork on show each summer where your father's farm sloped to the main road. So often we watched you step into that rough circle, your arms swept round the prongs of dangerous pitchforks. You seemed to embrace entire meadows, patting them like aprons about your knees. As you rose on your own foundation, people waved from bus windows. The more you spread and trod above head height, above hedge height, the more we had to stand back not to lose sight of you. You never looked like falling. Braced at the top, you fielded the two hay ropes, threw them back nonchalantly between your legs, and prepared to return to the earth. No memory now can match this. You gather your skirts and slide with a girlish flourish down the rick face, land like a gymnast among our outstretched arms. This poem came up out of a memory that was about 30 years old of driving along a road and seeing a gate in the middle of a field. The gate. There's a gate in the middle of a field. I can wait. No, I can't. There's a gate in the middle of the field. It leads into the middle of the field and out of it. We lean on the gate in the hedge that leads into the field and stare at the gate in the middle. Travellers point to the gate in the middle of the field. They approach and investigate. They investigate with mysterious purpose. They want to interrogate whoever put it there. They admire a gate that has gate crashed the middle of a field. Let all gates have such freedom, they think, bar none. Swing on the thought of a gate in the middle of a field where it is no business, long after the gate is gone. Remember that gate, we say, and at night in our dreams we head for the space in the middle. We pass and file through the space in the middle of the field and close, always reverently, the gate behind us. There's a couple of poems here, I'll just read one of them, about second-hand bookshops and the experience of second-hand bookshops. One of the poems is about the experience that nearly everybody has had of going into a second-hand bookshop, picking up a book, opening it, and there's the inscription, you know, that was originally made by somebody who loved somebody else or had the affection for somebody else, you know, and the book almost immediately got given away, or, you know, no time at all it appeared in the second-hand. Forgive me, whoever you are, who pasted the dry leaf into the inside back cover and filled the spaces around it with fragile endearments. Forgive me, how tentatively I have come to own part of your unhappiness. Calm it down for time.
You're okay, you've got another at least 12 minutes in total.
Oh, yes, that's right. Time to read the epic there. I wrote a set of poems called the Farmyard Haiku, which are kind of parodies of the haiku form. Best haiku I know is John Cooper Clarke's haiku. To convey one's mood in 17 syllables is very difficult. In this one there are seven haiku poems, and nearly all of them are spoken by farmyard creatures, and you can identify yourself what the creatures are. Number one, tight arse, waddler, I astound you with the perfection of my eggs. Disgruntled in the muck, we will never make music. Who gives a fuck? It took me ages to get the word disgruntled into a poem about pigs. I'm picky and I'm choosy. We are the wife's favourites. She calls us by name. Waddle or gobble. We need subtitles even among ourselves. This gander has standards. You won't catch me riding my wives in public. I am the bounty rooster. Oversexed, I'll say. By the way, you're next. And finally, and this is your thought for the day, and I want to bring this home with you. So. Balls the size of mine can only be compared to balls the size of mine. Well, I'm having a great time up here, thanks very much. I think I'll finish now with two or three poems. And I'll just put these at the end because I like them. This one's called The Butterfly House. One more butterfly in the butterfly house will count as overcrowding. Sun all morning and the heaviness of piped heat draws hundreds to the surface. They spend their days being exquisite in a history without wars. We are able briefly to forget the scaly intent, the cold-skinned thick slither 100 yards away in the tropical ravine. Hold up your arm, and with luck, you will emerge into the garden, badged and sleeved with butterflies, 1,000 bright sails opening around you. And this is the final poem. It's called The Hourglass, and it's a set of instructions telling my wife what to do with my remains, ashes, stuff. You know, it's a love poem, in other words. The Hourglass. There's a reference in this to Waterstones, and there's a reference in it to the Waterworks Park in North Belfast, and the school in the centre of Belfast where I've spent my entire teaching life, or BAI. When you collect me from the crematorium in a functional jar, my outcrops and knoblets and angular rough bones processed to a fine ash, instead of scattering me on a gusty day by the lake in the Waterworks Park, or releasing me stealthily from a Waterstones bag on the front lawn at Inst, I want you to sift a handful or two with care into the top half of an hourglass and set me to pass the days on our bedside table. From time to time, tumble me upside down for a posthumous workout. A punctual trickle and fall. If I must be the remains, let me be so as a soft grain in your living. You can look to me now, you can look to me daily for an hour of silent company, or tell at a glance you're running late again. Thank you very much for the welcome. Thank you very much. Send back the poems I borrowed from Paul Muldoon.